At the end of the symposium, all 6 faculty members came to the stage to address some of the many questions from the audience, and you can read answers to the other questions on research2practice.com. But the first question discussed in front of our audience was for Drs. O'Brien and Morrow.
A 22-year-old woman having leukocytosis at 60,000, mild thrombocytopenia 110, hemoglobin at 12 as part of a routine CBC that she had done for hair loss. She's diagnosed with CML, started on imatinib, achieves complete hematologic and molecular response within 4 months, remains the same at the end of 18 months on 400 milligrams. She's tolerating it with mild diarrhea and some weight gain. But what's your thoughts about the possibility of having children, getting married and having children, Susan? What about fertility and childbearing in patients receiving imatinib for CML?
Right. So I'm not aware of any issues with fertility, just the opposite. We have patients all the time that come in pregnant, but we don't want to do that. I mean, there is published data looking at the outcome of women who got pregnant, and most of the children were normal, but there were some, a recurrent syndrome that was seen in a couple of the children. So we don't want them, and that's actually not staying on imatinib. So in other words, if a patient comes in on imatinib and they're 2 months pregnant, we always stop it. So that's not even continuing it throughout the whole gestation, but maybe that early time period is the most crucial anyway in terms of developing abnormalities. So the bottom line is if they want to do it, it's a very tricky problem. I mean, if you have a patient in a major molecular response who's been on Gleevec for years, you probably have that 9-month, well, it may take longer than that to get pregnant, but you might have that year window or wherever where, yeah, they're going to lose some of their response, but they're not going to have a full-blown hematologic relapse. If it's very early in therapy, you're really stuck.
Want to elaborate on that, Mike?
Sure. So I could give you a little bit of a plan of attack for these patients. I had the luxury of working a higher profile patient who was chronicling all of her pregnancy and her CML therapy in Glamour magazine. So I'm the only hematologist who has blood in the New England Journal and a stack of Glamour in my office because she chronicles her CML therapy in there too, so I have to keep track. The points from her case were that A, stopping therapy while someone's trying to achieve pregnancy may not be ideal because that could be a very open-ended period of time. And I think with what we know, I think it's very safe to continue some as long as you're very tied into the obstetrics team to continue right up until they think they've conceived and then stop. So a briefer interruption. And then we had a couple of false starts, but we're only talking about, you know, 1 or 2 week breaks while someone was either found to be pregnant or not. And then, as Susan said, I think the quality of remission makes a big difference. If someone, this gal's, I wouldn't advise her after 4 months to now stop therapy and to get pregnant. If she had a stable molecular remission for a period of time, from the data that's been presented last year, and we'll see more follow-up on this year about interesting trials stopping imatinib, the criteria for those trials were continued molecular complete remission for 2 years. Now, I wouldn't borrow from that and say, well, that's the time that you can get pregnant, because we don't know how to discern which of those patients will relapse and will not. But that's probably a good benchmark to say that if you can wait a little bit and show us that you have a high-quality remission and don't stop while you're trying to get pregnant, take it until you think you're pregnant, and then we stop and we monitor. And you know, I've been lucky I've gotten this gal through 2 pregnancies without major relapse.
Ed, we had a number of questions, and David, we saw some heterogeneity in our patterns of care study myeloma in terms of the interval between bisphosphonates and how long you have to continue them. Ed, where are we right now in terms of that issue?
Well, the best data is old now and really looked at monthly dosing of zoledronic acid as well as pamidronate. And it certainly looks like giving it for 9 months was better than not giving it at all, and then giving it for 2 years seems to be better than giving it for 9 months. But there's really very little data in the long-term use of it. There's a recent study that has been completed, I believe, but the results aren't out yet, that have looked at changing the schedule from 3 months, maybe after 2 years, switching to 3 months versus 1 month, or after 1 year. And so as of this moment, we fortunately have become a lot more sensitive to the potential side effects, the renal insufficiency and the kidney damage, as well as the jaw osteonecrosis. And I think we're even more sensitive than we used to be to just the low-grade fevers and the general sense of aches, et cetera. And so I would say practice has moved to spreading out the schedule, certainly after a year or so of treatment, to every 3 months, I think we're very easily doing. But you know, we always have to balance the potential side effects of the bisphosphonates with the real benefits or the real hazard of having worsening bone lesions and the benefits of using the agent.
Dave? I concur with Ed's comments. There are three different potential sources for guidelines. None of them are evidence-based. One's ASCO guidelines, one's the Mayo Clinic has consensus guidelines, and the third is the International Myeloma Working Group has their own guidelines. And the guidelines are actually relatively comparable. But essentially all three recommend, again, it's not evidence-based, but essentially all three say that after some finite period of time for patients in remission, you can probably discontinue the bisphosphonates. Now, whether that's the way we really should do that or not, again, we don't know. The only trial besides the initial ones that Jim Berenson piloted that actually addressed this issue is one from the French myeloma group where they compared in post-transplant setting, and they found no benefit in reducing skeletal-related events after a year of therapy post-transplant. But that it really wasn't powered to look at it in enough patients to really answer that question. So the field has kind of trended to move to giving it less often, but I'm not sure they need to give it at all.
Another question, Ed, about myeloma. What about zoster prophylaxis in patients on bortezomib?
Oh, I think that's a really important issue that we frequently lose sight of. There's clearly an increased incidence of zoster, either dermatomal or even disseminated, in patients who begin bortezomib and are using that for a period of time. It was shown in the APEX trial in subset analyses and retrospective analyses, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 20% of patients will reactivate this. And so routine prophylaxis with acyclovir, I think, is very reasonable.
So, Gail, a bunch of questions about azacitidine and AML, both upfront and maintenance.
Okay. So azacitidine is being looked at both upfront and in maintenance. I think that one of the things that can be said so far from the randomized FANO study looking at azacitidine versus the conventional care regimens, and that was a study that was looking at intermediate to and high risk MDS, but there were patients in there who were right at the border of AML, and some of whom probably actually had AML, although more in a smoldering category. Now, in Europe, they're actually going to be looking at this specifically in patients with, I think, 20 to 30% blast, because the threshold in Europe was different for approval. But I mean, I think that the theory is that the drug is clearly active in patients. Just because you have 19% blast versus 21, it doesn't even make that much sense that if you blink twice in the microscope, the drug's not going to work. The question is how to use it and in what schedule, and whether there is a difference between quote unquote real AML, the exploding disease where you have a white count of 80,000 in a sick patient with DIC and all kinds of problems, versus what I think many of us still call smoldering disease of somebody who is not that sick, even though the bone marrow does technically meet criteria. So that's being looked at. I think also with decitabine, there are interesting data already from a year ago, and those are updated to some extent at this meeting for 10 days of decitabine, looking like it's having a 25-26% CR rate in AML patients. I'll just point out for one second that this actually brings up, so in MDS, the current thinking is that maybe CR doesn't really matter, and there's a lot of argument going on about this. It looked like for the azacitidine-treated patients that the survival benefit persisted even if they didn't meet strict criteria for CR, but the question is, how does that work with AML patients, and do AML patients need to get a CR for not only overall survival, but also presumably maybe quality of life as well, that if you're transfusion independent and if your counts are up, sort of seems logical that maybe your quality of life would be better. So I think the answer to the question is yes, it's being looked at. Yes, it's being tried. Do I try it? I do sometimes. And I think that there are probably going to be better data to guide people in practice to try to do that. The issue of maintenance, I think, is particularly interesting because obviously with elderly AML, there's been no survival benefit for 30 years. There hasn't been shown to be much in the way of overall survival benefit from any kind of prolonged consolidation or maintenance, but there have been flickerings of improvement in disease-free survival. So the question is that if you could do better in minimizing minimal residual disease or in somehow attacking the resistant cells that are left over after treatment? Might that be a strategy for hypomethylating agents? And I actually think one of the most interesting things about this meeting is not necessarily new fabulous treatment for AML, because I'm sad to report that that you're not going to find, but there's a lot on leukemia stem cells at this meeting, both in the big lectures and in the oral sessions. There's an awful lot about targeting resistant cells that are either left over after therapy or that are identified at the beginning of therapy, and that's an area for hypomethylating agents to potentially be used.